This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on Hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier, thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
I understand that you are emotionally attached to stuff far more than I can ever be. And my hearts are with every single Kansas City fan today. But that's all I can say. Listen, you want to, don't talk about pay. You don't know nothing about my structure.
It's a lovely chip. Oh, it's a brilliant goal from Lord Pohino.
Still, it's not away. Southgate's shot. Milosevic scores.
Could do with a bit of magic from him. Maybe this is it. It is! Andy Sinton from nothing.
Brian Roy has headed Forest into the lead.
Whelan. Oh, what a goal from Noel Whelan.
No power on it whatsoever, but Taibbi has made a horrendous error.
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Oh, and he hasn't.
No.
Hello and welcome to Quickly Kevin, Will He Score? I'm Chris Gold, joining me Josh Widdicombe.
Hello.
Michael is still set to manage a holiday, but we're lucky enough to be joined in the studio this week by Tom Crane, who's going to sit with us.
Yes. I assume that's... I felt like it was going somewhere. It's going to sit with us.
Well, Tom, we've just recorded this episode with Tom Crane where we discussed the Chester City documentary, Chester City, An American Dream.
It's very fun.
So we thought we might as well have Tom here while we read out your correspondence.
Lovely.
Delightful.
Let's get into it.
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the Electronic Postbag.
You've got mail.
Right. So this is from Stefan Allahand. Now... just so you know, I am going to collate all the players that have saved lives, saving people from swallowing their tongue, but I've had a busy week, so I haven't got around to it. So thank you for all your emails on that. We don't need any more. Thank you.
Hold your tongue.
Hold your tongue. That's what we can call it. This is in response to Gary Neville. Listening to the Gary Neville talking about staying in hotels before a game, a long dormant memory was reawakened. Back towards the latter stage of the 90s, I checked into a nondescript hotel somewhere in the Midlands, where I found something in my room that I found quite interesting and kept as a memento. It appeared that the great Manchester United team of the 1988-89 season had stayed there recently.
Ooh.
Before the game away at Coventry, 0-1 United, Giggs 78. Left behind in the drawer were the room details for the entire squad, obviously given to each player when they checked in.
Awesome.
Wondering if I still had it, I had a good rummage in various boxes and found it. I've now scanned and attached as I thought it may be of interest. It shows who shared with who and who was lucky enough to have their own rooms.
Brilliant.
Wow. What have we got?
Okay. The Nevilles shared a room, obviously.
Bunk bed, I hope. It's really sweetly, sort of. Same pyjamas.
Do you think that's just... There's something slightly emasculating about still sharing with your brother.
Can we guess any more pairings?
Yeah. Well, do you want one half of each pairing?
Yes.
Yes.
Who did Roy Keane share with?
No one.
Dennis Irwin.
The Irishman together. Dennis Irwin didn't get a room on his own.
I've got the original thing that he's... So this is called Rooming List Report.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want me to just run through the whole list?
Yeah, go.
David Beckham.
Ryan Giggs.
Solo.
Ooh. Yeah. Beckham had a room on his own.
Yeah.
Dennis Irwin, maybe 10 years his senior.
Yeah.
Had to share with Roy Keane.
I know.
Also, how gutted would you be to draw Roy Keane?
Really? Well, I don't imagine it's a new draw every week. Surely they're kind of used to each other's foibles.
Yeah. The thought of it. Worrying whether you're going to cough during the night, needing the loo, but not having the guts to get up and go in case you wake him. Just, yeah.
But. Skulls. Oh. Button skulls. Yes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Giggs. This is a weird one. Giggs and Cole.
Oh, really?
I would have never have got that. Mr. J. Curran, don't know who that is on his own. Mr. A. Ferguson was in.
With
Steve McLaren. No, he wasn't. He was on his own. This is one that works well. Ronnie Johnson was in with Henning Berg.
Oh, yeah.
Of course they were.
Right, it was
done along nationality lines.
Yeah.
The two foreign lads.
David May, Wes Brown. Neville and Neville. Schmeichel on his own. Stam and Scholskjaer together. Dwight York on his own. And Van der Hau and Jesper Blomqvist in the most disappointing room.
Van der Hau and Jesper Blomqvist.
God, no one's going there for a late night.
Do you reckon Van der Hau and Jesper Blomqvist are just going, we're getting away with murder still being in this squad. How are we in this squad?
Van der Hau are we in this squad?
Van der Hau are we here?
Very briefly, can we just quickly discuss, why do we think Beckham, for example, has got a room? How is it because he's a star?
I don't
but
know.
Roy but Roy Keane was massive. There's so many players in there that could easily say. I mean, Schmeichel, I can see, he's huge, big.
Yeah.
But why is
Beckham?
Well,
Schmeichel's got it because he's physically big. They've had to put two beds together in a row.
But do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Why is Beckham?
I think Ferguson would clamp down on that.
Exactly. That's what I find bizarre. Why is Beckham not in with Giggs or whatever? That seems bizarre to me. There's a weird sort of.
Maybe it was done on a kind of rotation basis.
Right. Yeah.
Dwight York gets his own room as well.
Yeah.
Remarkable. That's the 19th of February, 1999. I'm sure an eager listener could figure out what game that was.
It was away at Coventry.
Oh, away at Coventry. Mystery solved.
I mean, that is that. Great stuff. Okay, this is from John Lally. Hey, guys, love the podcast, which probably is obvious from the fact that I'm emailing you in a topic for you to potentially talk about. But how else should I start this email? Just name random 90s footballers? Fine. Stuart Nethercott, Neil Point and Craig Forrest. While listening to old episodes this week, I've been thinking about which players from this decade are the most 90s-type players.
Oh, that's nice.
The ones that will be in the opening credits of Aguero, I Swear You'll Never See Anything Like This Again podcast in 2038.
Yeah.
For my team, Tottenham, the most 90s player we've had this decade would have to be Vincent Janssen.
Did he play for Palace?
He was the guy that came to Spurs and didn't score any
Dutch
goals.
Striker, isn't he?
Yeah. Such a good choice.
That's a really good shout.
I didn't make a full list of teams, but I'm pretty sure Stephen Pienaar would be Everton's. No, I don't know what
That's
it. You
really
can't
good.
Like put your finger on what it is that makes them a 90s player.
That's great.
But that is That is a great topic. We should start a Hall of Fame from John Lally. So what we want you to do is nominate your current players that you think should have played in the 90s.
I've got one.
Yeah.
I think Danny Drinkwater would be sort of quite scrappy central midfielder with a sort of little British name, but with a tiny bit of flourish. Drinkwater. Yeah.
I think Danny Drinkwater as well. So we'll start with those three in our 90s players that have clearly been transported from the 90s to the present day.
I think it'd be good to ultimately end up like assign a player for every...
Yeah, right. So we've got Vincent Janssen up front, Drinkwater and Pienaar in central midfield.
That's not bad. That's not bad.
No. Complete this team with a modern era. Suggest your names. Hello at quicklygaming.com.
Okay, this is from Phil Bailey. Now, Crane, to inform you of this, previously we found out that a lot of people have tunes in their head that they sing when they hear the words Eddie McGoldrick.
Okay, yeah.
We've had four different, including mine, we've had three different other...
Do you want to know what mine is?
Yeah.
Eddie McGoldrick.
Yeah, we've had that one.
That's what it would come to. What was yours?
It's just made up.
All right, okay.
Eddie McGoldrick. So it's not even a tune, but for some reason I always think about it.
Yeah.
And mine is to the tune of Out in the Country by Cliff Richard. Out in the country, Eddie McGoldrick, la 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 la. So,
okay.
About his name?
I'm on board. I'm on board.
So we had an email from a listener last week.
Let's not read out the title. Just play what they've... So he sent us...
Just to add one more. So we had an email from a listener last week who said that they had Eddie McGoldrick to the tune of Come On Eileen in the head. Like, Eddie McGoldrick. Anyway. Eddie.
Okay.
So, we've had an email from Phil Bailey. The subject line is...
I don't say what it is because I want Tom to guess what the tune's going to be when we play it.
Fantastic. Here we go. This is Phil Bailey.
He's recorded it himself in his car.
Okay.
You got to speed it up and then you got to slow it down. Because if you believe that your love can hit the top, you got to play around. But soon you'll find the time for Eddie McGoldrick. Eddie McGoldrick. And repeat.
That's so good. One of the best things I've ever heard. Yeah. What an absolute legend.
For Eddie McGoldrick.
Yeah, that is great. Yeah.
Oh, the tune was wow.
Hit me one more time.
Wow.
Yeah. I just love the... Where was he? Has he pulled over to a hard shoulder? Is he in heavy traffic? Are his kids in the back? What's the situation in this...
He said, recorded this in my Mini using the steering wheel as my metronome.
My Eddie McGoldrick banger.
That's great.
Wonderful.
Eddie McGoldrick. That's great.
If you've got any more tunes for Eddie McGoldrick or anything else you want to talk to us about, this is how to get in touch.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin. And sign up to the mailing list @quicklykevin.com.
Okay, Crane, well, you're here today to discuss the 2000 Granada documentary, Chester City, An American Dream.
Hi.
What have you done for us so far?
It was like such a slap. So what really, what have you done for us? I have done...
I can tell you what we've done for you, mate.
Everything. I have done... I've done two of these documentaries, haven't I?
Yeah.
I've done...
Graham Taylor,
that's correct. And then what was the other one? That was
Barry Fry.
Yeah, there we are. I couldn't remember either of the names. What a start.
So you're very much a documentary specialist.
Apparently so.
And you're here today because you've taken a look at a new documentary.
Yeah.
This time slightly out of our era.
No, yes. Well, not quite. It was the 99-2000 season. So I think that counts as the 90s.
Clinging on.
It's the American Chester City, The American Dream.
Indeed.
A documentary by Granada Studios. And it was actually emailed in to us by Tom DaCosta.
Yes, thank you, Tom. Emailed it in last December. We finally got round to it. That's how far we are behind in our emails.
And it covers the story of Chester City in the 99-2000 season, as we say. How best to begin setting the scene here?
Can I just give you a little bit...
Did you know anything about it?
No, I did. I knew nothing about... I know nothing about Chester City, and I knew nothing about this crazy story.
I mean, we've watched a lot of these, haven't we, now? We've watched the Doncaster one and the Sunderland one as well. I don't know when in this to begin the discussion of why are people letting cameras into their clubs?
Yeah.
It's never a good idea.
Absolutely insane.
Who's the man? Is it Ian Atkins who comes in towards the end?
So Ian Atkins comes in, yes.
I read Ian Atkins giving an interview like 15 years later after this documentary was filmed, and he said that Terry Smith, who you'll learn about in a second, the American owner / manager, brought the TV cameras into his credit. More for himself, though.
Yeah.
I think we did get a great deal of publicity during that time. Even the likes of Alan Brazil on the radio adopted us as their team to follow.
I'd say that's the most positive thing you could say about this time.
Yep.
So we should set the scene. So it starts a couple of months into the 99-2000 season and Chester City aren't doing well. But, as we all know, those stories are 10 a penny in football, right?
And we all know it worked out for Chester City. 5 promotions, the Champions League, and like this is the past, and we've seen what's happened to that club since
How
then,
did it so. Begin?
Exactly. How did the road to glory begin?
So Chester have been, at this point when the documentary begins, they've been in Football League since 1931.
Yep.
Yeah. And what makes this a unique story is Chester have been bought by an American owner called Terry Smith.
Yep.
And he has also sacked the manager, Kevin Ratcliffe, and installed himself, despite no background in what he would term soccer,
yep,
as the manager. Now, what did you think at this point, well, apart from this is going to be fucking brilliant?
So there you go. An American who knows nothing about football, but buying a club and installing himself as manager.
Incredible.
However, he's just in Terry Smith's defence, if I may speak for him. Mm-hmm. He's got good NFL pedigree. He had 2 years of the New England Patriots. He then got into coaching. He coached the Great British National American Football Team. As a head coach, he went on to win three straight division championships with the Manchester Spartans as coach. He won three straight conference championships, two straight national championships, two straight European championships.
I'm gonna stop you. Is this from his Wikipedia?
Yes.
Yes, which right. was definitely written by him.
I was just about to say that. He's written his own Wikipedia. Yes. He's definitely written his own Wikipedia.
Little addendums to those things. First of all, playing for the Patriots, he bust his knee in the first game and didn't play for them again. But the description suggests that had his knee not been bust, he would have been the greatest player of all time. And then he did lead Britain to great success in gridiron, as it is described by the narrator. But it's up against Belgium, Holland, all those mighty forces. Yeah. So, but it's written as if he's the most important NFL coach of all time.
Can I read a bit from his Wikipedia, which is when I became 100% sure that he had written the Wikipedia himself? Because it is glowing throughout. So I was reading the section called Coaching Career. This was about him at Chester City. Now, in the documentary early on, it becomes clear he sacked Kevin Ratcliffe, who is his biggest rival. When they ask Kevin Ratcliffe later in the documentary if he said anything to Terry Smith when they played his new team, Shrewsbury, he said, "I've got two words for him," which, you know, lovely bit of, it means fuck off.
Yeah.
just could you see the cogs turning?
Thank you.
I was thinking Skull was going, what would they pay?
What could they pay? Well done.
Well done. This is what it says about Kevin Ratcliffe on Terry Smith's Wikipedia page. Manager Kevin Ratcliffe quit the job 4 games into the season with the team at the bottom of the table, having not scored yet in the league, attempting to claim £350,000 for a previously unknown contract that the administrator had not even known existed. An alleged contract that supposedly allowed him to resign by his own choice and still be paid this amount that was equal to more than 6 years of his managerial salary as a golden parachute severance payment. This made the financial situation even more difficult. That is not a balanced Wikipedia.
It's also two sentences.
Yeah. The language did not even know existed yet is a great, like, really petulant, like a teenager is kind of kicking off.
Just imagine Terry Smith swacking away at the keyboard at home.
At 4 a.m.
The big giveaway that he wrote his Wikipedia is the drop-down section penis size. Have you seen that, which is says largest on record? That's all it says, which doesn't say citation needed either.
So, obviously, appointing yourself as manager of a football team when you've got no prior experience is a mad thing. But in that same Wikipedia section, he explains why he did that. So they're in financial difficulty. It was not possible for Terry to consider hiring a new manager. And so Smith put together a plan to utilise the assistant coaches that were already in place. So he just made the best of the resources he had.
Just appoint an assistant as the manager.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what any other chairman would do.
He's done what all us sort of ex-championship managers dreamt of doing, which is basically installing yourself as a manager despite the fact you've got no real world qualifications. He's done this. It's ballsy, to be fair to him. I admire, and you'll see as the documentary goes on, you've got to admire the guts of the man. It's quite, if not the talent.
Did you like him?
Did I like him?
Because I didn't.
Did I like it? No, I didn't like him, actually, to be honest.
I did at the start, because I thought, this is a guy who's keen, who wants the best for this club, and I think he's in it for the right reasons. Mm. He's probably way massively naive. Yep. But as the documentary goes on, you realise, not to give it away, but he will eventually sack himself and yet remain in the dugout while the new manager's in there. You realise this is a bit of an ego trip at this point.
He's awful. He's not acting.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear from any chest... Before we go on, I know we enjoyed this documentary. It's a long time ago for Chester City, so hopefully you can see why it's... I imagine it was an awful time to support Chester City.
Yeah.
So we're not making light of the situation, but if you did support Chester at the time, I'd love to hear your reaction to whether our interpretations of the events that we watched are fair on Terry Smith.
Yeah. And
Terry Smith is listening, we'll happily do an episode where we interview you as well.
Yeah. I think it's important as well to describe what Terry Smith looks like at this point. So he's got a haircut that I haven't seen in a long time.
No.
Like balding on top, but the big, like, curly mullet at the back.
I describe it as Frasier Series 1 and 2.
Yeah. There's a sizable patch lacking hair at the front.
Yeah.
It's like he wears a toupee and he's driven to work in a soft top and hasn't realised it's blown off midway. It's the fact he's stuck with that and hasn't done anything to conceal this sort of huge gap.
The thing about that haircut as well is he knows the ruse because he's always wearing baseball caps at almost every opportunity.
I think it's also worth mentioning what he wears as well to go with that look. He wears shorts that are too long, white socks pulled up, but those huge white trainers that sort of like American parents wear to Disneyland. You know, those...
High tech.
It's sort of Balenciaga have ripped them off now, but they're like massive, it's just awful baggy t-shirts.
The Seinfeld.
That's it. It is. Yes, the Seinfeld.
Maybe he's a huge fan of 90s American sitcoms. So, he just wears Seinfeld trainers. He's got Frasier's hair.
Yeah, exactly. They won hardly any games, but he made loads of wry observations about what it's like to be.
There's one where he comes dressed in all of Chandler's clothes.
But yeah, remarkable man.
Can I just talk about the opening shot of the documentary? I love the opening 20 seconds is the best opening 20 seconds of any football documentary that we've watched.
Yeah.
Which is football fans literally crying on the pitch and screaming while an American man pleads with them to kind of show some kind of respect and sanity. And you just think, how... I can't... having not known what's going on, I'm like, why am I watching Chester City fans being crying while an American man pleads to them? This is going to make so much... There's got to be such a story here.
He's yelling, I'm here because I want to be here, not because of the money. Which, to be fair, does... That makes sense. As much as I criticise him, I would say that, it's not sort of the lottery ticket you think it might be, Division Three football.
So Dan Brooks is kind of, a kind of Waylon Smithers to his Mr. Burns?
Yes, exactly. Apparently he has some kind of American football background. I didn't kind of catch what that was. It wasn't very clear, but he deals with the marketing of the club.
Yeah, and commercial all
that
director.
Commercial director, that's the phrase. So, yeah.
And there's a wonderful scene where he's in his role as commercial director. He's going to a local business to talk to them about sponsorship. Yeah. And he's telling the guy who owns the company, you'll be able to put your name on our shirts and we'll put like advertising hoardings around that. And you just think, this guy knows that. it's not part of your job. You have to describe the fundamentals of how football sponsorship works.
He takes the bait, though. He does go for it, to be fair. So you criticise.
Yeah, he says that's a lovely proposal. I think he just didn't want to embarrass him in front of the documentary team.
So we should say on that that guy, there is the greatest twist at the end about what happens to him.
It's amazing. Okay. Yeah, if you think The Sixth Sense was kind of incredible.
So it starts, and Terry Smith is giving a team talk, and the voiceover is kind of describing how he's come from American football. Mm-hmm. What I like about the voiceover is whenever it uses an American term, it uses them, whoever it is that does the voiceover, with a total disrespect. Yeah. So they use the word gridiron in the opening sense, like it's a perversion. Like he's come...
it's weird. It's exactly. It's so...
I think at this point, just to give you a flavour of what Terry Smith is like, we should have a little cut of the kind of things he's saying in the dressing room and on the touchline. Imagine this if you were a player.
Remember, we go down the hill first. We got to get scores. We got to get three goals the first half. Getting after them. First half, three goals.
You shouldn't be way over here, way out. No. You ought to be getting in the middle of the action.
Get in there, guard! Come on, Rock, and drive them down! I can't believe that was an automatic penalty. Just got to send them off on that one. Listen, men, their whole attack is designed to pull our fullbacks out and then get the ball in the hole. They're doing it two ways. They're going long kicks, and then if you go up and fight for that header with him, he's just flicking it into the hole, and then we're getting in the hole. The other way, he's just trying to flick it in the hole. That's what all they're trying to do there. You just sit back and let him flick it, and you get it, just like you did that last time. We're not home and dry. Don't relax and think it's our ball game yet. It's not our ball game yet. We got to go out and get him. We got to take it.
No, hey.
He knocked him down, Ryan. He's going to just die.
So there we've got, we need to get into the middle of the action. Yeah. He pulled his jersey down. They're not putting the ball in the hole. It's not our ball game yet.
Right.
And that's a 1-1.
So sounds like weird quotes from a badly translated porno. there's far more than that. It's incredible. All these sort of, but I imagine a lot of these phrases worked in the NFL. If you'll see, yeah. kind of
he always is the ball game.
The ball game. Yeah, yeah.
Which is baseball, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
He's not even got the right American sport. Like, how much of a chancer is he?
Yeah.
When he has a guy for, I like. There's another one which we've got to discuss, which is when he says, "That was an automatic penalty." Automatic penalty.
Which, in my mind, I imagine isn't even in the area. You don't see where it is, but I imagine it's like on the halfway line. He just thinks it's that bad a tackle, it's an automatic penalty. Yeah, exactly.
Like when you pot the black in pool at the end of the game. That was one of his rules he introduced.
Yeah.
There was a black ball, and if you knocked it into the goal, it's an automatic penalty. It's secondary ball.
Can we talk about what the players must have thought? Do you think straight away they're like, I am not playing for this guy?
Yeah.
I think, watching this, and kind of the more we've watched these documentaries and you get an understanding, I think if I was watching that as a fan and it was happening to my club, I'd be like, why aren't the players, you know, not respond? Why aren't the players saying we won't do this? But then you realise that these are players who... This is their livelihood.
Yeah, mortgages, kids, etc. And this is the owner as well as the manager.
Yeah, so you can't do anything about it. You can't... You don't care enough, I don't think, as a player, and that's not a disrespect. You care more about your family than you do about the managerial direction of Chester City.
Completely. Apart from Peter Reid's brother, who's in the side and gets a bit moody occasionally. That's
Sean Reid.
That is Sean Reid, yeah.
What do you think? Would you have stood for it?
I mean, you can see in that situation that it's impossible to revolt.
Yes.
But like, speaking of revolt, like, it's within 10 minutes of the documentary, you can see the fans turning against them.
Well, the first game of the thing is a win. The whole documentary is a win. It's against Stalybridge Celtic in the Cup. It starts with the bleakest job I've ever seen, which is a man selling Chester City wigs and teddy bears outside the game. Another little thing I notice about Stalybridge Celtic is the font above their the entrance to the ground is in Comic Sans. Give the illusion that you're trying to play to some high level. What? And she's like, he's got the owner's got his teenage son to knock up something. But it's incredible. But the first game.
But
is,
do you reckon in 1999 Comic Sans was quite exciting?
Maybe, yeah. But now, with our jaded eyes, it seems lazy. But the first game, they're drawing at half time, aren't they? He then sort of
the team talks.
Yeah,
awful.
Well, he says in that game. Before the game, he says, "Remember, we go down the hill first. We got to get three goals in the first half minimum."
That's mad.
Not how you manage. You don't say we have to get three goals. I don't think that's the way it works. Is it just state we have to get this amount of goals?
Yeah, because what you're going to be dealing with disappointment.
Yeah.
You're not going to... But also, so how sloped is Stalybridge Celtic's ground that you need a three-goal lead because you're going uphill in the second half?
Yeah.
That can't.
It's a, yeah.
That simply can't be
It's as softly sloped as Comic Sans. That is...
Look, has he scouted that ground and gone, this is mad.
Yeah.
We're going to... Hopefully we need to... How important is the toss? Because you want to shoot uphill in the first half. Because then you know
what
you're aiming at.
It's like secondary school. It's all ground, pitches you play on then. Unless it's a phrase. I was wondering if it's like an American phrase. We go down. I don't know if it's easier in the first half. Maybe it isn't actually a... Because it seems insane to me that there would be... You'd get that rectified, wouldn't you? A sloped... Slope. Would you not?
That had a three goal.
Like you're playing screwball scramble. It's not... You would get that rectified, wouldn't you?
It's like a Savitio pitch when there was like a fold in it and it would really affect the ball.
I did a tour of St James's Park, Newcastle's ground, and the guy who gave the tour told me that what the gallows gate end at St James's Park is at 1.5 metres lower than the other end.
What?
And that there's been twice as many goals at the gallows gate end as the other
end. Twice as many?
That's a do I remember this right?
Yeah.
Well.
Any Newcastle fans?
Surely the Premiership must have... That would mean in the past then?
I know, I think to this day.
But would they accept that, really?
I don't know. I
mean, the Premiership... Yeah. Lords. Is it Lords or is it the Oval? I don't know. It's definitely. I think it's Lords. The wicket at Lords goes from left to right, it's better to swing the ball out.
Oh, really?
I can't remember the exact example of it.
But how is this stuff not rectified in professional sport? How
well, I think in cricket it adds an extra layer.
Right. Okay.
But tell me this. Would you prefer, if a team got into the Premier League and they had a pitch that went, one goal was 10 metres higher than the other?
Great.
How much would you love that?
I mean,
that would be preferable for me.
I'd have that the things they have in crafts, like tubes that you have to run through and little seesaw to plonk some stuff around, make it, yeah.
And no offence to whichever team I pick, but there's a lot of boring teams in the Premier League.
Yeah.
So were I to replace... were Brighton to be given full membership of the Premier League for another 10 years in exchange for having a 10-metre difference between the height of goals, I would back that push.
How would you deal with it tactically, out of interest? What would be your approach? Would you play men? Would you play... Would you change your team?
Well, the toss of the coin is huge in that situation.
Would it roll away from you for a start? How undignified that would be, chasing a 20p down.
But would it be difficult to play long ball if you're shooting downhill? Because you'd be kicking it too high all the time.
That's true, yeah. And would you want to play quick play? What would be the advice? What would you do?
I can't even begin to imagine what you'd do.
Yeah. Would you ever attack going uphill, or would it be too much effort so you just clear it and then...
I wonder if you could put an offside trap. I'm trying to think how an offside trap might be impacted by it playing.
What is the angle you're saying? What angle?
10 metres.
10 metres. So what's that degree like? That's...
Well, it's over 100 metres, so it's an incline of 1 metre for every 10 metres.
No, that's exhausting.
So it's a 10% incline.
When you're shooting uphill, that is a non-event.
Would you not
even
attack?
Happen. It's all about attacking downhill, and then you've just...
It would be so exciting.
It'd be like 50-48 a game, or whatever.
The news from the A-backs is Brighton are 6-0 up, and that isn't going to be an easy lead to defend.
In case the Premiership are listening, we should probably say this is our idea, and if you want to implement it, contact Josh, one of us, we'll discuss wages.
So anyway, they play Stanley Bridge Celtic. They don't get their 3-0 lead at
nope,
half-time.
They don't.
They need, because they're going uphill in the second half.
Yeah, and because they keep, as he says, they keep flicking it in the hole, is what he says over and over again, which the players don't understand what it means, and the assistant has to translate, basically, using two bottles of deodorant on the table.
Yeah.
So basically what it means is they keep knocking it over their heads into the corners, near the corner flags, as a way of trying to get it in. They're pulling the fullbacks forward and knocking it over the top of them. But he keeps saying flicking at the hole. But this is the thing, as you say earlier, the players don't understand him. And also, in my mind, I imagine as soon as he leaves the room, they're just like, what is this guy doing?
We
have to manage ourselves. I imagine that's what it is. It's that sort of...
What do you think he means by the hole? Because like, I would say the hole is probably just behind the strikers.
No, it's another problem with the pitch that's taking place.
Yeah, the penalty spot is 12 metres deep. But if you get it in there, the game's ended. That's what it is. But they do win that game 2-1.
Okay.
I think it's worth saying. And then he goes to celebrate with the crowd like they've beaten Juventus.
I know.
He's grabbing them all like high-fiving children.
He shakes every single person's hand in the crowd after the win.
Yeah. And it's an interesting window, that, because it's a brief moment where they seem to kind of like the theatre of it a bit. He feels like a character. This is obviously before it's all gone wrong.
Yeah.
So this is the beginning. And the fans are reacting with warmth to him. They're like, Terry, they're hugging, and there's a sort of fun to it, a pantomime to it.
Yeah. And I kind of think with football, if you win, like, that's the battle, isn't it? Like, if he'd have won all these games, we wouldn't be, like... I'm sure we wouldn't be talking about Terry Smith.
There's a lot of points when, later in the documentary, where he's trying to kind of justify his methods.
Yeah.
But they're just not backed up by results. So it's total madness what he's doing.
Yes. But no acknowledgement that what he's doing is terrible.
No,
which is what's amazing.
They're bottom
really.
Of the league.
Yeah.
So exactly. He keeps saying that they're improving, and you're like, yeah, but that doesn't matter if you're bottom.
Ian Atkins went on to say later that he didn't understand the fundamentals of football. Like he loved analytics and stat and stats. I guess that's what American football is good for, that stuff. But he gave the example: they had lost to Leyton Orient under him, but they'd beaten Leyton Orient under Ian Atkins later in the season. But Terry Smith was fuming because he'd had more possession when they lost. And he was telling the extra, well, we had more possession when we lost, but you had less possession today and you won.
That could be traded in at the end of the season for some extra points. It's all toughened
up. And Ian Atkins had to explain that it's not always about possession.
So they go into a school, don't they?
Yeah,
so
that,
straight away
after the first game, we cut to
their main effort to try and get more fans.
Yeah, which is school visits.
And Terry gives a wonderful explanation as to why they're bottom of the league. To just remember, he's answering a school child when you hear this.
Yeah, we're working our way up, but we started out slowly because the thing was that, as you know, the club had some difficulty last year, and then we've just come in this year, and it's our first year in, and so we're trying. So it's building up and to get better. So by the end of the year, we hope to be in a position for right near the top.
So essentially, there's a bit there where he tells the kids that their parents have to take them to Chester,
and then they're all wearing like Liverpool shirts.
Yeah. And the kid who asks where are you in the league's in a Man United shirt, absolute slam as well. He knows where they are in the league.
And like Terry's level of spin for this school child, like, well, yeah, we're on the way up. Just say you're bottom.
Yeah.
Like, just say you're down there.
Can I just read a thing on the similar subject? Because I read an article about Chester City afterwards. So one of the reasons Terry Smith came in is the previous owner was probably worse than Terry Smith and had left them in a seriously bad position. The fans had backed Terry Smith buying the club to save them.
Yeah.
But this gives you an idea of how good the previous owner was. So, owner Mark Goodsman had planned for Chester City to establish themselves as a feeder club to Manchester City in 1996. The idea was quickly put to bed when he was petitioned for bankruptcy and it became apparent that Man City board didn't want anything to do with it. He later got himself in hot water with a publicity stunt that backfired. Season ticket holders of clubs outside the third division were allowed into the Diva Stadium free of charge, a plan which was supposed to lure in hordes of local Man United, Liverpool, Man City and Everton supporters, but went sour when it became apparent large sections of what would have been the paying crowd were turning up with and not paying to get in using season tickets of friends.
No.
So his idea was like, if you had a Man U season ticket, you'd come free. But Chester City fans are like, I've got a mate who's a Man U season ticket.
I'll just use
his season ticket.
I assume you were going to say that they turned up in shirts, as in the shirts of the relevant clubs. That's why I laughed. I thought, are they going to be turning up in sort of Leeds shirts or Arsenal shirts as a way to... But that's amazing. So even the club, when they were struggling down at the bottom, people were, you know, people. Eh?
I know. And I mean, the story of Chester, I mean, it gets worse after Terry Smith, but I'm sure we'll get onto that in time.
So he goes into school to do this talk.
Yep.
It doesn't go brilliantly. Also, you just think, is there any other chairman... who is doing school tours?
Yes.
Have exactly. I misjudged that? Like,
why are you hitting a section of the public who have no money? Like, 8-year-old children are not going to bankroll your club. I love the fact Junior Agogo's there, who actually is a player I sort of remember from old Football Manager and stuff. But he's head in his hands when the kid asks, where are we in the league? And he's like, oh, God. Like, literally, that is, you know, you've got us there, kid. But it's a remarkable decision.
I know. Like, their theory is clearly to get the kids to tell their parents to take them to Chester.
Yes.
What, my parents would have been fuming if I said the school today had a chairman from a different club and he told me that you have to take me to see Chester.
Yeah.
They'd be down the school complaining.
Yeah,
it's a weird talk.
That's terrible.
But I wonder whether it was part of like a deal. So they'd go in, they'd do a bit of training, and as a kind of make weight for that, he got to do his little spiel about how they should come to Chester City.
Yes.
Don't blackmail them, just tell them it's a...
But they keep doing it, because he goes back to a school later in the documentary, doesn't he? And they have a kick around with the kids. One of the kids takes a penalty, hits the striker in the balls. Sort of, they all laugh. But it's great TV.
So after the school visit, we see some training, which Terry just kind of walks around at, like a kind of ghost.
You know his big idea in that, they say, is... it's. The big change is now they implement 6-hour training sessions.
Oh, yeah.
Too long. I don't know anything about football, but that is... You shouldn't be able to watch Shawshank twice. That is too long. Like, if you're... Well, they wouldn't be professional, technically. Yeah, they wouldn't be professional players.
Yeah, they would be.
But 6 hours of non-stop training.
I've done 30 hours running this week.
3,000 penalties, I hope you get one. But, yeah.
So then they play Man City in one of the cups, I presume? I don't know which cup it is.
FA Cup third round.
FA Cup third round.
Mm-hmm.
They ask the Smithers character, I can't remember what he's called.
Dan Brooks.
They ask what his prediction is. This is a point that always surprises me. You know when people ask for predictions in football matches and they give a really precise prediction?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, what a bizarre... Like, if I was asked, what do you reckon will happen in this football match? I go, I reckon England might win that. But he says, it'll be 2-2 and we'll score in injury time. It's such a weird thing.
Yeah.
I think, wow, the best we can hope for is that we're losing going to, into the end. It's such a weird, precise thing.
People, yeah.
Fans always do
they
that
do,
as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was quite surprised he came up with the phrase injury time as well. I assumed he'd get that complete, like, yeah.
Overtime.
Oh, that's actually the correct phrase. Yeah, overtime. So he thinks, yeah, 3-2, doesn't he?
2-2,
then 3-2, nick it.
No, no.
Oh, does he think it's a 2-2
draw? 2-2, just 2-2, but we'll just equalise.
Doesn't even think they'll win. No. Amazing. Okay.
Always surprises me that bit. And then they're just awful, aren't they? Lose.
Well, it's 1-1 at half time.
It's 1-1 at half time.
Yeah, and he says to the manager, what's his name, Terry, comes out, speaks to the players, and says it's like running a marathon. You've got to push yourself through the wall, keep pushing, keep pushing. You'll remember this in 50 years. Hard cut to them losing 4-1, which is also all kind of collapses around them. But yeah, I mean, but this is kind of the first proper team talk you see in giving, where it's that sort of like American striding around. It's clearly it's like an NFL style of
like
doing
any given
it.
Sunday.
Yeah, it really that's exactly what it's like. Like it's really inspirational stuff about when you're older and you look back in your careers, you whatever it happens to be.
Yeah,
it's he probably imagined there'd be sort of swelling classical music, people crying, but obviously it doesn't really work like that. You've just got Peter Reed's brother looking nonplussed and then. Struggling to get on some tiny shin pads, I don't know why. And then they lose 4-1. But that's the thing. He has this mentality of sort of like the real American style G up. You can do this. This is your big moment. It just never works.
And then you get to the next scene, which is a fans meeting in the club bar.
Mm-hmm. Love this. Which is the most depressing club bar I've ever seen.
My favourite is detail. There's a lot. It looks like. There was a period when my dad was into pigeon racing, and it looks like the kind of place that they'd have their pigeon club meetings.
Are the pigeons there? Are they? They sat in little stalls and kind of chipping in.
There's a kid there eating a bag of crisps, and on the crisps, the brand is Crisps. It just says on it, Crisps.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It's like an alternative universe.
Well, it's like they've got the crisps, but they couldn't clear Walkers.
Yeah.
So the props have had to make something that he could hold in shot that doesn't have a brand on it. And they've just written crisps.
On his feet, on his feet, it just says trainers on the side of it. T-shirts.
Yeah. What do you think of this meeting, Chris?
I feel so sorry for the supporters of this football team. You see, they're all like they're all really sensible football fans in a way that you don't really see in the Premier League. Like, I think down the leagues, they're all in it purely for passion.
Yes.
They've got no other motive than they want the best for this football team, and they're all quite well spoken. And the woman who sat at the end smoking a cigarette like, with her legs crossed, and she's the one who says, what he knows about football could be put on a postage stamp, referring to Terry Smith. And the line she's completely
that,
bang on.
She hits on it. The line before that I find almost more damning, which is, he is not a manager, he does not know anything about football. Which is, what a thing to hit. Like, if you imagine a well-known manager now being sacked or being questioned, he does not know anything about football. But you're quite right. But there is a sort of, there's a genuine heart to these people. They do love their club. And it must be sort of absolutely heart-wrenching to see someone who doesn't understand the game and won't relinquish
and
control.
So frustrating.
Yeah.
I remember when we had a bad chairman at Plymouth in the 90s. And there's nothing, you feel so powerless.
Completely.
You feel absolutely powerless.
Especially when these supporters have backed Terry Smith to get him into a position where he became the owner. They helped fund his takeover.
Yes, yeah. It's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. And I think as well...
Imagine backing someone who then makes themselves the manager.
No, and he's mad. Mad American.
Yeah. Didn't I mention I was going to make myself the manager?
I'm also playing in the hole just behind the...
but you always, I always think about, like, I thought about those people at the end of the documentary, you know, yeah. it does end sadly for Chester. But you think, when a club's in crisis, can you not always tell? Like, it's so obvious that those people in that room, they were doing everything they could to avert this crisis, and nothing could be done, seemingly, to avert it. It was like,
I wonder if there's ever been a club where the fans have been that frustrated with an owner who has then turned it round, like completely turned it round. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yeah. Mm. Well, this Mike Ashley is a sort of a degree of...
No, they haven't turned it
round. That's what I'm saying, but that frustration is clearly what the Newcastle fans feel with this person who won't relinquish control, doesn't put enough money in. Every season it's like, please, please. And that must be awful. It must be awful. But you see how detached he is from... what they think, because afterwards it says they say they want to meet him, they want to have a fan meeting. He refuses to do it, and then they interview him afterwards, and he says the supporters are making assumptions based on a complete lack of knowledge of what's going on. You're bottom of the league. It's not a complete lack of knowledge of what's going on. You're losing consistently. They're basing it on rationally looking
at
results and performance, and they want something different. It's not like you don't understand. Oh, I've improved his right foot. You don't see that.
You just see
us losing 5-0. You're losing all the time.
It's mad. Absolutely mad.
Well, it sounds bleak, but I'll refer you to Terry Smith's Wikipedia on this specific phase. It says, using a low-budget strategy, along with increasing revenue through excellent cup runs in the FA Cup and the Worthington Cup, and with increased attendance and commercial advertising, Smith was able to get all the club's debts paid off within only 6 months, which was 2 years earlier than the administration required.
Yeah.
Small footnote on that, they didn't file accounts for 3 years.
Is that true?
Yes.
Amazing.
He also ends it, first time the club was out of debt for the first time in at least many decades, possibly in history.
Yeah.
That means fundamentally
so
untrue.
Fundamentally, I cannot believe the Wikipedia page is this, but anyway.
Did you see, and not to sort of reveal the most amazing thing on the Wikipedia, I'm sure you read it, he appointed captains for defence, midfield and attack.
Well, you say, you bring this up.
Yeah.
So this is another clip relating to Terry Smith's time at Chester City that I found. I think this is from something like Football Focus.
My name's Ross Davidson, captain of Chester City Football Club.
My name's Nick Richardson, I'm the captain of Chester City Football Club.
My name's Luke Beckett, and I'm the captain of Chester City Football Club.
Will the real captain of Chester City please step forward? Strange, but true. A club with three captains and five coaches, but no manager. The side picked by its American chairman, applying gridiron principles to his first experience of English football.
Good work!
Miss anybody? I'll just go real quick through the points. All right, back four, remember, playing basic 4-4-2 rules. Martin's an extra.
Basic 4-4-2 rules.
We're playing basic 4-4-2 rules.
If you weren't, let's say, so he's playing 4-4-2. If you're not the captain of the strikers, how heartbreaking that is. 50% chance. How much your strike partner will be pulling rank. Just remind you. You are literally, yeah.
That's mad. I hadn't thought of it like
I own
that.
You, basically.
Do they all wear captain's armbands on the pitch? I couldn't work that out from the documentary.
They toss the coin together, all three of them. He's overthought how much the captain matters.
Yeah.
So he's made an issue where there isn't one.
Yeah, entirely.
Around this time, we find out that the previous manager, Kevin Ratcliffe, says, you know, Terry Smith came in.
His arch nemesis.
Yeah. Terry Smith came in and made loads of promises. He said we were going to buy some internationals. He mentioned a lad from Iceland. The banter in the dressing room was, we're going to sign another lad from Tesco's next week.
Great. Lovely.
Is that a joke? I was wondering, is that a joke about Terry Smith being a bullshitter? Or is that a joke about how absurd it is to have someone from Iceland?
I read it as slightly hateful towards other nations. Like the idea that someone from Iceland could be any good.
Yeah, do you reckon Kevin Ratcliffe was sat watching the Euro 2016 going, that joke doesn't look so good anymore.
Yeah. Also at a point that Ida Gudjonsson would have been at his pomp. You're... Chester City, yeah. Or well, whoever he would have been then, Leighton, wouldn't he? In Orient, wouldn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Like, no, Shrewsbury Town.
Shrewsbury Town, yeah. One of the best strikers in Europe was from Iceland. But yeah, I'm not quite sure about that. That sort of
it was a weird moment that in the documentary.
It was, yeah. But for me, the weirdest moment. I think they're getting ready for the big game, Chester versus Leighton Orient, a big relegation game. What song are they playing in the dressing room beforehand? Mambo Number 5.
Mambo Number 5.
That has never G'd up anyone ever. Apart from maybe Lou Vega.
In the dressing room, before the game, they're listening to Mambo Number 5. And the only reason you hear them listening to Mambo Number 5 is they have to stop it to do the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah.
Which is...
Yes. Oh, yes.
So bizarre. No, I've got obviously nothing against anyone who's religious, but it is so bizarre in the UK footballing dressing room.
Yes.
To be A, playing Mambo Number 5, B, stopping it to all say the Lord's Prayer together.
But it isn't even like he's decided this is what he says to his assistant manager. He says, here in England, do you ever say the Lord's Prayer? Because we do that all the time in America. So if it's the epitome of just clutching at straws.
Yeah.
It's gone, maybe God will help.
Well, I'm not one to, you know, write Richard Dawkins' next book for him. But purely on a statistical level, it doesn't look good for God if the only team that says the Lord's Prayer are bottom of the whole football league.
Yeah.
A 92nd out of 92.
Yeah, completely.
Like, if they were mid-table, I'd go, well, you know, that he can't do everything. He can't win the Champions League.
Yeah. But it's remarkable. So they all bow their head and he sort of stands in the middle of them and then there's that sort of like awkwardness that's just finished and they sort of file out. But this is it. He's completely detached with what the players actually want at all points. And this is kind of...
Yeah.
The epitome of it, really, isn't it?
What's the score at half-time?
They are losing 2-0.
They're losing 2-0.
At half-time. And he says, we are one goal away from this being anyone's ball game. This is his phrase.
Yes.
And they do get that goal.
And he says, goal and then another one after that.
He also describes them in a word never used outside of the Chester City dressing room as you've played a lousy game.
He does, yeah.
It's final score in this game, Chester 1, Leighton Orient 5.
At home to Leighton Orient, who were bottom.
And in the dressing room after the game, his words are, the most pitiful damn effort I've ever seen. He actually begins it really passively, aggressively. Okay, thank you for the most pitiful damn I've ever seen.
Thanks.
You're like, oh, yeah.
It's really it's the most passive aggressive thing since in one of these documentaries. After when Graham Taylor gets the linesman to thank the referee for costing him his job. You know,
As Terry Smith goes down the tunnel after the game, he's lost 5-1. He's confronted by two people leaning over the tunnel.
Yeah.
The first person says to him, please, Terry, go. Really polite.
Yeah.
And then Terry walks a couple of paces to the guy behind him who says, why don't you just piss off?
And slaps him on the back as well. What a mixed message. There's also a really brutal bit. They're quite cruel in this section of the...
he's ruining the club.
He is. No, not the supporters. In the documentary, they really stick the knife in. And they have a quote from him, sort of like during the Leighton Orient game. They cut away to him discussing how he feels he's been treated. And he says, over here, there's a tendency to take a person who is a good player and then make them into a manager. But coaching and playing are very different things. And then they cut to him failing to control a ball on the training pitch.
Yeah, I saw that.
It sort of bounces past him. He lifts his leg, like sort of, you know, when you imagine sort of you're walking through the park and some kids are playing football and they kick the ball in your direction and you think, this is, I hope I deal with this with some dignity. I manage to trap it.
He totally misjudges the bounce.
Completely misses it. Yeah, it's so amazing. But yeah, and then you're quite right. So he sacks himself after this.
He sacks himself. Rightly so.
Yeah.
I don't think he's just awful. Yeah. I don't like talking about this now. I'm just like, this guy, what's he doing? Why does he care about Chester City? Yeah. Why does he care about ruining Chester City?
Because he's got an ego.
Yeah.
I think that's what it is, really. I think he
well, I've read his Wikipedia.
Yeah. But he's so desperate to sort of prove them wrong. There's a lacking there. There's something there where it's kind of
awareness.
An itch he can't scratch, where he's just kind of, he needs to prove to them they're wrong. He can do this. He has this attitude. If you can believe in anything, you can whatever. Which means he just won't let go. He won't admit he's wrong.
And it's just becomes worse and worse and worse.
So Terry Smith sacks himself. He appoints Ian Atkins, a manager of decent pedigree at this point.
Yeah.
But what does Terry do? Terry Smith surely now is going to go up to the boardroom and assume the role of an owner. Wrong. He's in the dugout from now on. Sitting right beside Ian Atkins, and it's not explicit, but there does seem to be tension between them.
Yeah.
I'm not sure Ian was sold on this as an idea.
Well, at the board meeting where they have all the fans there to introduce the fans forum to introduce Ian, he sat next to Terry Smith, and they say to Ian, what do you reckon will happen? And he says, well, one thing for sure, I think the lower down clubs will now know they're in for a scrap, whereas 2 weeks ago, they might have thought Chester's a club that's only going down.
Yeah.
And he sat next to the guy that was managing them 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Absolute, such a slam. His little American eyes got squint. He looks so... So clearly has no respect. This is day one, and he has no respect for the owner of the club.
They have a little a Q&A with the fans. Mm. And one of the fans says, Ian, can you assure me that Terry isn't picking the team? Like, why is he in the dugout? Yeah. And Ian says, Sam Haman sits in the dugout for Wimbledon, and they do all right. I'd never heard of this. Did you know Sam Haman?
No.
So I looked it up.
Yeah.
Sam Haman would sit in the dugout on occasion. I don't understand the context, but there's pictures of Sam Haman at Old Trafford wrestling with security guards because he's like over-celebrated in the dugout.
Wow.
Really?
So Sam Haman,
so would he have any say in it?
No, Well, from what Bobby Gould alluded to, I think he's definitely having some sort of input.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is your... Didn't he say to Bobby Gould, this is my football club, not yours?
So the fans
only
are basically
knows, but
saying...
That's a story for another day.
The fans are basically saying, please tell us that, you know, just Terry will not have anything to do with it. And then they cut to the back of the room at the fan forum and Terry's stood there in a baseball cap.
Yeah, it's
the shadows.
So Ian Atkins is being interviewed by the fans. This is not the unveiling. This is later on.
Yeah.
And they're all just slagging Terry off.
Yeah.
Ian Atkins fine with it. And then the cut to the back of Terry stood at the back in his baseball cap was one of the bleakest things. Do you think the fans knew he was there?
Surely. They must be so sick of... This is the moment at which I was like, I'm so sick of Terry Smith. He's not in this for the right reasons anymore, I'm not sure. Like, and as a fan...
You say
must
that,
just
but in the next scene, he does another school visit.
So...
Yeah.
Another school visit. You're not even the manager anymore. You're just the chairman.
Yeah.
Imagine if you found out that... To give you an example... John Henry was going around the schools of Liverpool. Or, like, Sheikh Mansour was going around the schools of South Manchester doing talks. Like, it makes no sense. It makes absolutely no
sense.
Trying
to get kids in. Yeah. Saying you must get your parents to bring you to Man City.
Yeah.
So there's a line in this documentary the narrator delivers, which is a line we've heard again and again in almost every documentary we've done. But it's a context specific to Chester. And he says... Carlisle is a game they simply can't afford to lose.
Yeah.
Well, we've been here before.
Yeah.
Just to add a little context. So, Carlisle versus Shrewsbury. This is like the second from last game of the season, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or is this the last game?
No, last game is Peterborough.
Yeah, this is like the second or third to last game. They absolutely have to win this game against Carlisle to be in the hunt and have a realistic chance of survival.
We've seen sort of footage of a team training hard. With Terry also depressingly at the training sessions with a clipboard, as he always is, just but leaning on the post in the court. It's really,
yeah, it's
always
so lame.
Has to be there, always has to be in the sort of like.
You know, when a manager is sometimes a manager, we've kind of realised managers aren't at all the training sessions.
Yeah.
Why is the chairman there? Surely he's got better things to do with his time.
Absolutely bizarre. But he's watching, writing things down on this. He always has this clipboard, which I find amazing. I did some Googling about him afterwards. There's one thing Chester City fans might, I'm sure, will know about this. Apparently it's quite a famous thing. When Chester played Dunstan United once in the FA Cup third qualifying round, it was wet and windy, but he was stood on the sidelines and he felt he couldn't see the match enough. So he climbed on top of the clubhouse to watch it. There's footage of him stood up on a corrugated iron roof with his clipboard in hand and like gusty wind and sort of like the fans hate you already and there you are. Sort of.
Oh my God.
But yeah.
He's just mad. So it's just
going from bad to worse. Ian Atkins' form picks up, but then they get to the Carlisle game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Needless to say, they lose. I didn't even make a note of the score.
The main note I made was at halftime, they cut to the kind of director's lounge. And there's two men looking at a big screen showing teletext.
Oh, yeah.
And what are they doing it? They're stood up eating soup from a bowl with a spoon, which is just the most undignified.
And on the side of the bowl, it says soup. As is the way with this
It's
club.
Just a really undignified way to eat your soup. Just... It's not the. It's not
Who
the...
are they? Because also, I think that that looks like it's sort of the where they have the guests and the like the suite for is. Sort of,
yeah, it's like the sponsors or whatever.
Exactly, they're laying on the soup.
It might have been the guy earlier who heard he could get his name on the shirt.
So I think this they it isn't included in the documentary. They lose, win a couple of games.
They
after
do lose, conceding a goal 2 minutes into injury time.
Yeah.
And it cuts to the dugout 2 minutes into injury time. They concede a goal, and everyone's distraught apart from Terry, who's. Giving a kind of motivational clap and saying, we can do this. And yeah. You're like, you're mad.
Yeah.
You've just gone 1-0 down on the 92nd minute. Just...
Not now, Terry.
Not now, Terry. You're not even in the management team.
So somehow, they lose to Carlisle in the last minute. There's obviously the distraught after the game, but they pull a couple of results together and somehow they find themselves in the last game of the season with a realistic chance of survival.
Yep.
Can I just make a point just before this game? Ian Atkins is interviewed about relegation to the conference. And Ian Atkins comes out of the documentary quite well. But there's a mad section where he argues that the quality of the teams in the conference are just as good. So relegation isn't really that bad.
Yeah, she dumped me, but actually being single's kind of cool now. And like with Tinder and stuff, you can just kind of meet people. It's just great. It's a great place.
But he says, like, the teams are just as good. The main issue is that it's not called the Football League. If it was called, like, Division 5, then we'd be fine with it. But
the grounds
like,
are better. A lot
you're
of the
still a league below. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
They've just rebadged it.
Yeah.
They've just rebadged it.
Actually, pretty much all the leagues are the same. Pretty much the Premiership.
What is a league? Also, it's just words.
Yeah. Exactly.
Just words.
Yeah. Do you know, if you turn the newspaper up the other side, other way up, then we're top of the league. So...
So, the big game, Peterborough at home. Ian Atkins, who's the manager at the time, interviewed many years later, gives you some context as to what was happening in the team in the days previous. Their star striker is a guy called Angus Eaver, who they'd signed. He said, I was told a couple of days before the match that he was off playing somewhere with Trinidad and Tobago. I couldn't believe it. Here we were preparing for probably the biggest game in the club's history, and we were without one of our better strikers because he was on international duty. We were frantically ringing round trying to get hold of him. We did eventually get in touch with him, with one of his teammates who was waiting for a plane at the airport with him. Angus wouldn't speak to us, though, and that was the last we heard of him.
Oh.
So we went, we went into the game with the lad Terry signed, Steve Finney, starting up front for us. He'd hardly had a kick since I got there, hadn't scored all season, and yet we were relying on him to help keep us in the league.
Oh.
Things got worse on the day of the game, though. I had a phone call from Matt Doherty, who'd been great for us all season, saying he couldn't play. He'd been arrested after getting into a fight on a night out in his hometown and was sitting in a police cell. I knew as soon as I heard this that things were not destined to go in our favour against Peterborough.
Well, so, none of that's in the documentary.
None of that.
We should just say they're playing against Peterborough, managed by Barry Fry, who doesn't make an appearance, disappointingly. Yeah. I was hoping for a crossover documentary appearance from Barry Fry.
But in the Peterborough lineup that day is a man whose name I can't believe hasn't come up before on this podcast, that of Gareth Jellyman.
Oh, yeah.
Gareth Jellyman.
Was he left back?
Yeah, I think so.
Was, yeah.
I went on to Gareth. I haven't thought about Gareth Jellyman in years. So I went on his Wikipedia. He's got a whole section of his Wikipedia dedicated to how silly his name is. It begins, Jellyman's name is homophonic with jelly.
Yeah.
Which sounds the same.
Yeah, yeah.
The subject of numerous jokes. This most notably appeared on Sky Sports Soccer Saturday, in which presenter Jeff Stelling said, oh no, Gareth Jellyman's been sent off at Oxford. Let's hope he hasn't thrown a wobbly.
Nice.
Lovely. Imagine that thing on your Wikipedia.
The Jellyman sounds like a sort of a scary, as a kid.
From X-Files.
Yeah, exactly. There'd be rumours around that if you were outside in a field near, after midnight, the Jellyman would get you. Come and hack you down or something.
Gareth Jellyman plays Peterborough, who obviously aren't really the story. The story is that Shrewsbury, who is managed by Kevin Ratcliffe, mm-hmm. who is his big rival, it's either them or Chester to go down, amazingly. Shrewsbury are at Exeter. Let me take you through the final day as I remember it from the documentary. The key thing isn't really Chester's game.
No.
The key bit is the news coming through from Shrewsbury.
It's incredible.
So at halftime, Shrewsbury and Exeter are drawing. Then Shrewsbury go ahead and you think Chester are doomed here. Then the unthinkable happens and it cuts to Terry pumping his arms at the crowd. And below it says, the news has come through that Exeter have equalised. And then it just says, it wasn't true.
They'd actually scored.
It was what it like. It was one of the whole crowd are cheering, and it's one of those last day rumours that you don't get anymore. Yeah. That swept a stadium, and everyone is in the misheld belief that results elsewhere are going there, gone their way, and it's absolutely not true.
There's a 20-second window where that group of people are the happiest they will ever be.
Yeah,
I suppose there's some kind of joy in the fact in that brief pocket of time. They did feel something. They did feel an absolute joy. It's
well,
hard to replicate.
Do you know what I'd compare it to from my own football life? The only comparable false news that I've ever received was when Raheem Sterling scored after 2 minutes in the first game of the 2014 World Cup. And then it even went up on the score thing and then it just hit the side netting. Yeah. I couldn't... That for me was like... I can't believe that isn't talked about more. As a moment.
Yeah.
In the worst World Cup we've ever had. After 2 minutes, we thought we were 1-0 up, and it had even gone up on the score.
Yeah.
And that was in 2014.
If you were a Chester City fan, would you have wanted, retrospectively, would you have been glad that brief window of confusion was there so you get to feel that?
No, it's more painful.
Do you reckon it is? Yeah. Yeah, it is more painful, isn't it? It's more painful.
But well, it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. Is it better for... Is it better for Exeter to have scored?
Yeah.
And not, than never to have scored at all?
But I think psychologically as well, like, people just, how does it work? Does it just, you see people cheering and just want to believe? Like, surely there's enough cynical people in there, but especially supporting
but
Chester
if,
at that
I would say, if people are, I imagine there's normally someone with a little radio at that time, wasn't there?
Yeah.
So if the word's passing around, you would believe it. You're not going to be cynical. You're just, it's very hard to get that fact wrong.
Yeah.
But they have somehow managed it. but yeah, and then the Aston comes on the bottom to say actually it was wrong, as you say, and it's just
and they
cruel.
Do get relegated,
and it just kind of fades into black, really, doesn't it? And it just says what happens after the documentary ended.
So what are you feeling at this point? Did you feel they did with these things? I've never seen one where they avoid relegation. Peterborough,
yep,
or Doncaster, or Graham Taylor not making the World Cup, or Sunderland getting relegated. I've never seen one of these with a happy ending.
Apparently, if Ian had been in, basically from the point Ian came in and managed to the end, had it just been him and those results, they'd have been seventh in the table, which is cruel. So he did really well. The form was really strong comparatively. What screwed this up was the ego of this man who was unwilling to see his own failings. And it's a remarkable sort of document of someone's, you know.
Absolutely. But the madness of him. Accepting the cameras in sums it up for me. Late and Orin, that's another one where it went wrong. Literally every single one.
The fans on the pitch at the end of that game, I mean, real grief, like proper grief, because they know, like, they're not coming back the next season, and they don't.
All
obviously.
Three captains weeping. Throwing off their three arm brands.
Should we talk about the postscript of the documentary?
Yeah, because it's the best bit.
So,
so it just says what everyone's been up to since.
Kevin Ratcliffe, who left earlier in the season, replaced by Terry Smith's manager, but kept Shrewsbury up. He kept them up. Got a £200,000 payout the next day after Chester went down. Dan Brooks, the commercial director, now manages the girl band Perfect Ten. In one of the weirdest postscripts to any football documentary ever. Definitely
perfect
ever.
Perfect 10, the girl
perfect
band.
Perfect 10, yeah. What a decision.
Do you know anything about Perfect 10?
They've got three captains.
They've got three. The Perfect 10's Maradona, isn't it? That's what it was. Was he number 10? He was, wasn't he?
Yeah. Perfect 10, girl band.
What does he say?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. No.
What a decision.
Yeah, incredible.
Who would be your favourite Let's just say chairman to leave and manage a boy band or girl band.
Girl band. Yep. Sheikh Mansour?
Sheikh Mansour, yeah. Every time.
Every time. What did you think of it as a documentary?
I
enjoyed it.
I did enjoy it. I felt awfully for the fans.
Yeah.
I thought, what did I think? It was fascinating. But it's just kind of remarkable that someone could be so stubborn and so sure of themselves that they're...
I think as well, like watching that, I think smaller teams, if you can use that term, in the lower leagues, they're fighting for their survival, the existence, like the whole time, and what that means to the community. And I think they were in such trouble that when Terry Smith came along, it must have been harder the way it ended because they think, this is a guy, an American, he's a bit glamorous.
The hope
of that situation, and for it to be so much worse than like it seemed, you know, the previous situation.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man. And then they go down.
Where are Chester City now? Where are they?
Well, do you want to know what happens to the characters depicted in this documentary afterwards?
Yeah.
So Ian Atkins left the club after relegation. It was replaced with a gentleman by the name of Graham Barrow, who's a popular figure with supporters. But Graham Barrow had to endure very difficult circumstances himself. Terry Smith suspended Barrow's assistant Paul Beasley from playing for failing to stand in the correct position at a set piece. And he banned Barrow from speaking to the press without his permission.
Oh, my God.
Bit controlling, I think it's fair to say. Do you want to know how Terry Smith's reign came to an end?
Yes.
He did leave in October 2001 to return to his homeland to work as a teacher.
Really?
Why, he loves schools.
Perfect. And Bill Belichick took over, didn't he? He has the...
It's a bleak old documentary.
That is what it is. That's exactly what it felt like. But good to be able to watch it.
Yeah. Well, Chester, they ended up going bust, I think it was, in 2010, but they're back as Chester FC. And
great.
Yeah, they're in another conference.
There we go. The conference, which, as we know, is as good as the Premier League, according to Ian Atkins. Tom Crane, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Let's say, for instance, Sean Reed was our captain. He's injured now, but he was our captain. He was in midfield. There's a lot of times in a game whenever... all the other players can't hear him. He might be up front, and the back four obviously can't hear him there. He might be chased a ball back into the back. The strikers can't hear him. So really, there is no confusion at all on it at all. I mean, we have one captain who's the overall captain, and then we have a captain that's a captain of each segment of the field.
Thank you to Tom Crane for watching that documentary. One day we're going to run dry of those documentaries. Before we go, we have to do Review Haiku.
Yes, every week we ask you to leave your reviews on iTunes in the form of a haiku. We pick our favourites, and if you're selected, you win a Graham Says Hit Les mug. I've got two for you this week, gentlemen. I begin with this. From WRJ1506, who says, "Hail Gus Caesar, a murder of Jason Crowes. Stand up, Glenn Helder." Billy Joyce.
Very nice.
And we've got this, a reference, of course, to Nigel Martin's preference for drinks. "Nigel's at the bar. Pint of your finest, landlord, fat or semi-skim."
That is great.
Great.
It's got to be that one, isn't it?
Richard Potter from Froome, you have won a Graham Says Hit Les mug.
Now, we always end with a quiz, and the winner gets to choose the song we play out on. This week, while Michael is on manager holiday, I will set the quiz. Tom versus Chris.
Oh.
It's a classic quiz format. What I'm going to do, I'm going to name a year. Mm-hmm. We haven't done this in a while. I just want you to name me any team or player... player that won an individual award,
mm-hmm.
for instance, player of the year,
yes.
or the world footballer of the year,
right.
or team that won a professional title, international or domestic, in 1996.
Right.
So, for instance, if it was 1994, you could say Brazil World Cup.
Yes.
Or Manchester United, the football, the Premier League. Okay. Tom, as the guest, 1996, any team that won anything or any player that won anything?
Germany.
Won.
Well, you're a 96.
Correct.
Manchester United won the Premier League.
Correct.
Right. Manchester United won the FA Cup.
The winners of the 1996 FA Cup between Manchester United and Liverpool was Manchester United.
Hey!
God, of course, Cantona. So you can have any award as well. I would say Player of the Year.
That's such a gamble. Yeah.
Here we go.
Eric Cantona.
PFA or Football Writers?
PFA.
The 1998 PFA... 1996 PFA Player of the Year was... Les Ferdinand.
Yay!
Why didn't I... As soon as I said that, I thought, why didn't I do Charity Shield?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what would you have gone for, Charity Shield?
I think it would have been Blackburn versus Everton, wouldn't it? I would have said Everton. Do we know the answer? Put us out on misery.
Slightly embarrassing, you chucked in another wrong answer just for no reason whatsoever. You didn't have to dig yourself any deeply, but you decided.
The 1996 Charity Shield between Manchester United and Newcastle.
Don't fancy your chances, I'll be honest.
Seeing as we've already established that Manchester United won the league in 1996, yeah. It would be a fair guess that they also won.
Everton! Where did Everton come from?
Oh, of course, because it would have been
the league and cup double, yet you'd gone with Blackburn versus Everton for the Charity Shield.
I'm thinking the 95-96 Charity Shield.
I didn't realise. Oh, you should have said.
You should have said. It's the 1995 Charity Shield.
Well, I've been wrong twice in that one instance. So
incredible.
So, Tom, you get to choose the song we play out to.
Right. And does it have to be football related?
It can be anything you want.
Anything you want. By the way, Everton beat Blackburn in the Charity Shield.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
That's fine.
What is the Everton club song?
They come out to the theme from Zedcars.
Let's play Zedcars just to rub it in for Skull. There we go. Zedcars.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, mate. We'll be back next week. Until then, Robbie Slater. See you later.
Bye.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.